What up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Another Dream Report. I'm your host, Pablo, and joining me, as always, is Mr. Brian Schultz. You sent me a list of what we got to talk about, and you said this is a lot, but I think we can do it, and I think we can. First up, we got to talk about the Penguin. The viewership numbers, Brian, are exploding. I was reading the article that you sent about that. Some tidbits about episode 5 and my reaction to episode 6. I just saw that last episode. Disney pulls Blade. Is this like a surprise? Like, if you've been watching this show, you know this is not a surprise.
Told you. We told you November 1st. Yeah. Don't put that in. Don't put that in marker.
Now they're trying to fast track Midnight Suns. Team up, Brian, that we've and many have talked about for a long time about the potential of it happening if they start off with Blade and so on and so forth. And it was one of those, I guess, momentous team-ups similar to the Avengers, X-Men, and so on and so forth that could have done, could have been successful for them. Who knows? So they're trying to fast-track that. And Armor Wars writer speaks out.
Speaking of projects that we tell you not to count on.
Exactly. And some interesting insight into the James Mangold idea of the genesis of the Force. It is just an interesting topic of wondering what this looks like at its first, I guess, wielding of someone. That is fast-tracking. Some lanterns news. I think you and I discussed that it would be somewhat of, John is the new recruit. And Hal is the OG, and he's showing him the ropes. So this is possibly that. Netflix animation. You mentioned Tomb Raider and Terminator Zero. I'll have more of an insight and perspective on Terminator Zero than I do Tomb Raider, because I was watching Tomb Raider, Brian, and the first episode did something that turned me off immediately. We'll talk about that. But Terminator Zero is something else entirely. I saw Venom. You saw the picture that I posted. If you follow me on IG, you saw the picture that I posted on a Friday IMAX. Empty, pretty much. And it seems to reflect the actual numbers, Brian, and the actual response people have towards this franchise. Penguin, episode 5. Viewership numbers are exploding. Your thoughts on the episode and what this series is doing for the genre? And what this could mean for the future of the comic book, not necessarily in film, but on TV, man.
Well, I continue to love this show. People continue to love this show, but I really like that the creators have a clear structure and a plan that they want to follow, and it makes a ton of sense. So from the very beginning, we've been told, this show will pick up right after the events of the Batman, specifically the killing of Carmine Falcone and the flooding of the city by the Riddler. So if we think back to our premiere, we are dropped right into that. We're brought right back into the movie from Oz's perspective. We then proceed to spend parts of the next couple of weeks with a fair amount of retrospective. We kind of get the same event taken from Vic's perspective. We get the same event taken from Sophia's perspective. And I love it because that's what you should use television for. You should use that additional showtime to lay your groundwork. And so we got to the mid-season point, which was the conclusion of the Sophia episode. And obviously we bring back to present day where she offs all the people that have wronged her over the past decade. And it's kind of like the show's creators were sort of being like, okay, class is over. Is everyone up to speed? Everyone's got their backstory. Everyone's got the context. Now we're going to wind this thing up and we're going to go. And to me, episode 5 was go. It was go time.
Yeah.
Because, like, to me, it felt there was a lot of propulsion, there was a lot of forward momentum, there was a lot of cross currents, and then we get to a very classic comic book moment at the end of that episode. We are underneath the city. They found a way to give the Penguin sort of their version of his classic lair in the comics, and it's like, this show brings those threads together where you're sort of like, all right, the chess pieces are on the board, people are in motion making moves against each other, and I feel like the second half of the season is going to be very kinetic, whereas the first half of the season was awesome, but was a little bit about exposition, a little bit about world building, and making sure we were all up to speed. So 10 out of 10, I loved it. I loved it. And I loved what episode 5 brought in terms of rhythm. Vic has forward momentum in this episode because he's tasked with hiding Oz's mother, right? Without really necessarily having the criminal experience or the, you know, police know-how to kind of hide a witness. He's basically got to think on his own and use his instincts. So that's forward development for that character, right? And I kind of like that. Oz obviously has momentum because now he's on the run, right? He's sort of, you're seeing him seeing the angles taken away from him, and then he's trying to figure new ones out of that.
And that's been the story throughout this. He's always, is like, the sort of, one of the themes of this show is, how's he going to do it? How's he going to get out of this one? In this episode, did she get Vidi?
Her forward momentum is more direct, right? It takes the end of episode 4 where she wipes the slate clean.
Yes.
And then it shows her machinations to kind of pull Maroney to her side and remake the family in her own image.
Okay.
Sophia as crime boss.
Yes.
Which is critical. And you see literally blood money, literal blood money. Uses to basically get the buy-in of all the underbosses and all the henchmen. And you knew Vidi was going to get killed at some point, so you figured it would be in graphic fashion, and it was.
Everybody keeps talking about that scene, yeah.
But Christy Milioti sells it because when she uses the fashion, right? She kind of goes into her mom's closet, and you can tell she's kind of deranged, right? So she comes out, and she's costumed up, and then she's delivering the speech at the table. And, you know, it works, man. It's a little comic, but it's a little like De Niro and the Untouchables. Like, it's raw.
It's raw. It's getting down to the bare bones of the motivations of individuals.
There's some interesting ramifications that are going around. So Kristen Milioti may have Colin Farrell this show. And what I mean by that is, so Colin Farrell's turn as the Penguin in the Batman led to his getting this show because he stole.
You think that, Ryan?
Well, there's a lot of rumors going around that Kristen Milioti is now being written into Batman Part 2, or being her part is being upsized in Batman Part 2 because of this show. So that would be her taking her role in this show and forcing Matt Reeves to make her a bigger part of the Batman's world going forward, which would directly contravene my betting odds, which would have been that she dies in this season. I just would have thought there's no way that both she and Oz could get out of this season, but maybe there is a way. Maybe Reeves did have a plan for that, but it seems like there is some talk that maybe we will see Kristen Milioti on the big screen in 2026.
This ending, Brian, of the Penguin will be very, I imagine that the viewership is going to be out the roof for the finale of this season. Because this is supposed to lead towards Batman 2, correct?
God. That's what Reeves said. It's supposed to be a direct lead-in. And the idea that we have to wait 2 years for that is...
Just imagine.
Every week
Can anyone out there who's watching this show just imagine that in... just a few weeks when that at the end of this season, the following weekend is the premiere of Batman 2. Just think about it.
Here's the thing. People like us would be there for the opening weekend of Batman 2 no matter what. But that's not what this is about. It's about, when we talk about the viewership, it's about the people that are coming out of the woodwork who don't watch comic book adaptations who are being sucked into this world because of this show. They're the people that if you fed them Batman Part 2 the week after the finale would be like, yes, I'm now in.
And
I maybe didn't even see the Pattinson movie in the theater, but I'll go see the sequel because of this TV show.
But the numbers for that movie have gone up on streaming.
For sure. But I'm saying, like, you know, from a studio's perspective, this is why I do think Penguin Season 2, it's inevitable at this point. We'll talk about the viewership. And it's going to be positioned to lead directly into Batman Part 2. I think they're going to make amends
for what happened here. Yes.
I think that's my prediction. Yes. Season 2 of The Penguin will end 1 to 2 weeks before Batman Part 2 comes out.
Would it surprise you if Season 2 includes some aspects or perhaps some aura that is perhaps revealed at the end of Penguin Season 2 of the Court of Owls being involved?
Very possible. And in fact, you know, with Reeves saying that Penguin was supposed to lead directly into Part 2, what is directly? See, that to me is the writer's liberty, right? Where you could add more detail. You could add another season to bridge more directly from Penguin Season 1 to Batman. But there's always ways to do that. So to your point, that also offers you opportunity for parallels. It offers you opportunity to introduce some characters that are going to get ramped in Batman Part 2. You might even do like concurrent chronology, where you could sort of have like, hey, you're going to see in a little bit of Penguin Season 2, maybe you'll see some storylines play out from Oz's perspective, then you will see the Batman's perspective on that a week or two later. You can do things like that now because of where this show has gotten to. But I just refuse to believe they're going to miss this opportunity twice, because now, Pablo, the two numbers that matter. Every episode has received more viewership than the last on day of viewing. So on HBO proper and on Max, the people who are watching it Sunday night, more people are doing that every single week. That has not happened. That has not happened since Game of Thrones days, like early Game of Thrones days. That's number one. Number two is the number of people who have now seen the first episode of The Penguin is almost 3x what it was in the first week that it came out. That shows you the amount of, so now we've had 14, 15 million people that have seen Penguin episode one that are finding the show and then starting to catch up. So this show is reaching the Game of Thrones phenomenon level. And we haven't even reached the end of the first season, to your point. So yeah, like this is a major blockbuster where you're going to have Emmy nominations and you're going to have real zeitgeist buzz for what comes next.
Is it possible that Renzi Feliz could be up for a nomination as well?
I mean, sure, why not? I mean, they'll enter him. I don't know if who he's up against, right? That's the thing. We never know.
So
like, could he earn a nomination? Sure. His part is incredibly hard. And he's also, let's not forget, he's kind of the audience avatar as well. He's our entry to watching these people. He's the normal person, right? And he's digging us into the world. It's a really hard job that he's being asked to
play. That's why you got to watch this. Once you watch this episode, you got to tell me about what you thought about it.
And the thing is, like, he's a young actor, right? And it's like, you can't get acted off the screen by
27 years old.
Colin Farrell, who's absolutely like out of his mind in this show. And I think you could argue Milioti's topping him. And then you've got the mom character who's pretty pretty wild. Like, Vic can't be out. He has to at least stand toe to toe with them for the show to work. And he's doing it.
Brian, he is really doing it. I'm proud. I was reading some information about him. We should do a segment where we look up stuff and we do it brought to you by Perplexity AI. That's what we should do. Because it gives you everything right there. Hey, right? Might as well use it. But he's a Dominican. He was born in the South Bronx. He moved, I believe, to Florida. He's 27 years old. Dominican American, which is the first time I ever heard of that term. So I'm Dominican American, but it's good to see I guess I would say my fellow countrymen doing something at this level, Brian.
Yeah.
Because he's doing a phenomenal job. Phenomenal. And you see the transformation. And I think after episode 6, think about that question. Could he be another person whose name is thrown into the hat where this show just sweeps mad categories, Brian?
Well, look, I mean, this past year, we saw this happen with Shogun, right? We saw it. We just saw this happen in the dramatic category.
Yeah.
Where a show came out and, you know, you're riveted immediately by the lead. But then as you get into the roster, you're like, everybody is bringing their A game, right? Like Blackthorn to Anna Sawai to Hogan from the Thor movies. Like these guys are crushing it to where they all swept, right? That's what happened. And like this show has that same kind of momentum to it. And you get into it and you're like, pretty much everyone who's on screen is delivering. Now, I would say I did not love Mark Strong as the replacement Falcone. That was not my favorite.
I liked
Totoro better. And it was interesting to see Totoro apparently was offered the chance to replay the role, and he chose not to because the character was revealed to be so violent against women. He actually said specifically he didn't want to do it for that reason. So I thought Strong's version of it was not as compelling for what the character was portrayed to have done versus
it's
what I think.
Definitely took a different take. A more reserved.
And I didn't like that.
Less character, more reserved sort of portrayal of that character. And I felt that it fit within the environment that they've created in this show. I don't know. Maybe it certainly could have worked, but I didn't mind that change.
Maybe I would have felt differently had Strong been the character all along, but I felt like the way Totoro played it in the Batman versus the way Strong played it here was a little too different to my taste to be like, okay, that's the same guy. And then this guy is reported to have had this almost fetish for hanging women at the club. Like I didn't quite buy it. I didn't love it. So.
Yeah. And he was a young guy. So is this sort of a resurgence of the comic book films, not film, but the comic book having been announced, the possibilities of Deathstroke and what was the other one? Deathstroke and Bane. Ryan, I need to hear, although we'll get into the conversation about that if you want, about Agatha and that world.
I don't think they're comparable. Like, okay.
But still, they're being talked about very highly, Brian, based on the stuff that I've read. But what do you think are more, certainly executives are looking to do things. I mean, listen, we're getting Green Lantern. And we already know that is up for already.
Yeah.
You know, is at a bar. It's already at a bar because of the people involved in there.
Yeah.
So what do you think about this possibility that the comic book, although in film, has been very not a fun ride as of late, but on TV is doing something different?
Well, I mean, you could argue it's cyclical. Comic books on TV have been a thing for 50 years, 60 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we think about like Adam West Batman. That was a hit. It's a big deal, right? We don't think of it. It's not at all like the Penguin.
Yeah.
But that was a big deal, right? It was like Burgess Meredith was the Penguin in that, right?
Yeah.
Before he was Mickey.
Yeah.
So you had that. Linda Carter, Wonder Woman, Bill Bixby, Incredible Hulk. Right. So this is the 60s and the 70s. These shows meant something. They became culturally significant on some level.
But then you got the greatest American hero after that.
No, but then like, you know, then, and we're staying in, I'll stay in live action and then I'll talk about the other, but like, you know, then you bring it forward to, you know, Smallville's premiere in 2001.
Oh yeah.
The biggest show that had ever been on CW ever.
Yeah.
You know? And so that was a huge moment of Superman growing up. And that was, And on Lois and Clark had that, or it was Lois and Clark, right? Dean Cain and Terry Hatcher in the 90s, right? That had a moment where that show was a big deal. They were on the cover.
I never really got into it, but yeah.
No, I'm just saying the genre's life on TV has oscillated between being a big deal and kind of being like derivative to laughing stock. I think the Penguin and Lanterns are pushing for territory we haven't seen yet, which is there's a stratosphere of television that has typically been reserved for certain types of shows that have always done really well, like true dramas, you know, really intense actor acting type of show. I think Game of Thrones broke the mold in terms of what kind of show people could conceive of winning those types of awards. You could argue that success maybe begot something like Shogun 10 years later. People thought, hey, I could turn that novel into a true award-winning show. I think The Penguin is making people, it's validating something that I think DC has gotten right, which is that with HBO at their back, we take TV seriously and we can turn these things into the biggest deal on TV. The fact that there's a cape or there's a moniker for a supervillain doesn't limit us. I think what all those other shows I mentioned had a ceiling, right? Adam West had a ceiling. Smallville had a ceiling. They were nice shows at points, but there was a part of the audience they were never going to touch.
Yeah.
These shows say that's not good enough. We can get to everybody. And the fact that we're based on a comic book doesn't stop us from reaching that level. We've never had that before. And I don't think Marvel's at that level. I don't.
Oh, hell no.
I think it's an insult to the Penguin to put Agatha in the conversation. I don't even want to it's not even a conversation I'm willing to entertain. And it's not that Agatha's a bad show.
Yeah.
It's just that to me, everything Marvel has done in live action TV, with the exception of Loki, and even Loki, I don't think got to this level in terms of its notoriety, is derivative. It's sideshow entertainment. And you know it's sideshow entertainment when you're in it. When you watch The Penguin, he's a sideshow character to Batman, but he don't feel like a sideshow character in this show. It doesn't. Green Lantern, the two highest profile Green Lanterns are going to headline a show. That's a big deal. And if you take that very seriously and say, these guys should be getting nominated for Emmys and we should be going head to head with The Penguin for an Emmy, that's a big deal. And that's why I think, you know, people can doubt like whether Diana's going to be in Paradise Lost, but that's why I think it's going to push them in that direction that, you know what, it is not an insult to mainline characters to introduce them on prestige TV. Like Marvel's still treating TV like it's second rate to the movies.
Yeah.
DC's not. It's not. Like, I think Matt Reeves, to his credit, is treating this show very much as like, I've changed the medium.
Yeah.
But the value I ascribe to Penguin versus Batman is pretty similar. I'm just using the vehicle differently to get you from place to place. But the production value of this show and the quality of the acting and the quality of the writing is testament to the fact that there is no drop-off. And in fact, you could argue there's some improvements over what was in the Batman in this show.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. All I got to say is, man, episode 6 takes it up to another level. The discussions of this show being one of the best shows, period, ever to be on TV is definitely a debate I would like to hear with regards when you hear of shows like Breaking Bad and other shows, Sopranos, you name it, the big ones. Penguin is up there with them. And it's just amazing to see how much better it gets and how much complex it gets. And it's just phenomenally done. And I'm glad I'm watching this show. I'm glad I was able to. I would say again, this episode is, and I was talking to Brian earlier, this is disturbing yet phenomenal in terms of the performances and the directions that these characters take. So let us know in the comment section below what you guys think of Penguin so far and what it means for the genre. Next up, some tidbits. Let's stay with DC. The Lanterns, the storyline. John Stewart is a new recruit. How they show that, Brian, is very important.
Official language describing the show. That's why I sent it to you. It wasn't a rumor. It was described by HBO as, quote, new recruit John Stewart and Lanterns legend Hal Jordan.
Okay. What will be interesting, Brian, to know is what is it about this mystery that brings this legend with this new recruit together? And will that at the beginning of this series, will John not be a Lantern just yet? Will it take a few episodes? What are your thoughts? What are you speculating?
I think it's validating some of what we discussed. I'm going to say new recruit to means we're going to get, it's an origin story for John Stewart and his induction into the Corps, which means I think we're going to get John Stewart military man. I think you're going to see a little bit of that. I think a classic TV structure would be to give you some kind of set piece or some kind of early show episode that provides a backdrop for what his skill set already is, why he would potentially be, you know, a candidate for the ring in some capacity. I think Lantern's legend really sets the stage for Hal having an ego, right? Like, why would Hal be feeling himself and be kind of feeling like he's the authority on all things Green Lantern? Like, yeah, they refer to him as the legend. So I'm guessing he's going to carry himself as such. And that I think is perfect fodder for the kind of partnership and the kind of dynamic that we would expect from this show, and having Aaron Pierre and Kyle Chandler. Yeah, they're on the same side, but there'll be moments where they're definitely pushing against each other and clashing about methods and, you know, techniques and lessons. So I think the fact that they've officially labeled it as that is just sort of a confirmation of where we are in the development of the path of these two characters. And it's what I think we would have wanted. So it's great. Yeah.
I can't wait. The feelings that we have for the Penguin will certainly be pent up feelings that we'll have at the beginning of Green Lantern, in terms of the excitement, in terms of what we're looking forward to seeing, especially after seeing a trailer, getting more details of what this is about, who is in it. All these questions that we have and all the little tidbits that we get out of that camp are exciting news I just can't wait.
The TV question, I just want to add a little bit of something here because of Lanterns and Penguin. I think you can make a case that the genre as a whole, you could argue, if Lanterns does what we think it can do on the back of Penguin doing what it's doing, and I feel like we have to bring this in here, when you layer in what was produced by X-Men 97, the possibilities of Caped Crusader, I'll even include Blue Eye Samurai here too, a little, even though it's not technically a comic book adaptation, but
What I would say for Blue Eye Samurai is the fact that it's doing what some of these comic book shows are doing. It's telling a compelling story. Go ahead.
The structure is very comic booky, even if it's not based on a Marvel or DC property. My point is, the genre is trending up to unprecedented heights in animated form and in live action television form, at the same time that it is trending down in an alarming way in movie form. And we certainly hope that turns around, but I'm simply pointing out that if things like Superman, Fantastic Four, if these things do not succeed, I'm not saying the industry will give up on superhero movies, but the output will continue to decline. There's no question. Mm-hmm. And what will happen is, I think, more of the mainline characters will move into TV, because if that's where they're successful, that's where they're going to go. Like, so I'm not saying that Brave and the Bold will turn into a TV show for sure, but I am saying that if Superman fails and if Supergirl fails, like, is there a world where Brave and the Bold never happens and instead the next iteration of Batman is actually as a TV show on HBO? That's not impossible. Don't tell me that's impossible if the Penguin wins five Emmys.
Not impossible.
And Green Lantern is nominated for four. Don't tell me that's impossible that Batman isn't headlining a TV show in 2029.
Brian, it would fulfill the very dream I've been asking for many, many years. If you've been following this show and my other collaborations with Egghead News, I've been talking about Batman TV show. So to sort of do the deep dives that these characters get in these shows, Brian.
Sure. Or you could do individual story arcs in live action. It's like, we've seen some of this work. DC Animated has crushed it through the years, but it's like, why couldn't you do, I mean, you could say right now it's impossible to conceive of Dark Knight Returns being conceived of anything other than a movie right now. And I would agree with you, but I'm saying, imagine we can't get the movie thing turned around. Imagine Superman can't do it. Imagine if even like Batman Part 2 is great, but the box office goes down. Like, it's not impossible. And so I'm just saying, like, 5 and 10 years from now, is there a world where it's like, you know what? We'll do Dark Knight Returns. We'll do it as an eight episode limited series.
Why? Yeah, why not? Right? Did that right? Like, Watchmen and they did it, you know?
The IP is going to be there. Where it's going to be, I think, is being debated right now. And TV is making a strong case that you can, in some ways, do better things with the main characters and some of the supporting characters like Penguin on TV than you ever could on the big screen. Because if Penguin was a 2-hour movie, it would not be nearly as good as it is right now.
No.
No chance. No chance. Because you would have to cut out like half of what we've seen. And this show doesn't work without that.
Blade. Silently. Like a thief in the night.
And by the way... Rewind the tape, because remember when we got that story about like, oh, they had all the directors in. They even had that other guy, that James Samuels, that was going to direct it. He had to get on social saying, I'm not doing that. And then they were like, November 1st, it's going to happen. We're all set to go November 1st. And then we get an updated calendar and Blade is just gone.
We told you that no way this was happening.
And the key is there's no, it's gone. There's no, hey, it's been delayed to this date or it's been delayed to this year. It's just been removed from the calendar entirely.
When do you think Mahershala Ali speaks on this?
I mean, my theory on his exit has always been that it would come up after it's already happened. Like, if you remember how Aaron Pierre revealed he was no longer the villain in Blade. Mm-hmm. He was doing red carpet, not for Rebel Ridge. It was something prior to Rebel Ridge. And someone asked him about it. And he just said, oh, I haven't been attached to that for months. The new version they're writing doesn't have me in it. Right. So like whatever had happened went down like long before it came public. That's always been my theory with Mahershala. They would never like make an announcement that he wasn't Blade.
Yeah.
My thought had just been, it wouldn't happen. And then he'll be doing like a press junket next year for like the Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah.
Someone will ask him. Yeah. He'll be like, you know, we tried like this and it just wasn't meant to be, but I hope someone else does a great job as a daywalker. That's always how I imagined it would play out.
Yeah. I've always stated that the MCU never had a specific thought in terms of the future of Blade with that respect and that it deserves, similar to Wesley Snipes. Wesley Snipes' return is what's gotten it back as big as it is again, not the Mahershala Ali situation. Granted, the MCU hasn't made any moves with it because they really never had any plans based on how that all went down. And you already know, Kevin already said it.
Yeah.
He came to us. That's what this is about, Brian. That phrase right there that Kevin said, that's what this is about, says everything you need to know about this franchise. Not necessarily about the franchise, Brian, but about how this went down. I'm not saying he did a rock move. I'm just saying that Mahershala Ali, I'm pretty sure, thought of himself as a possibility to play the character. Who would have said no? Anybody you ask. Of course. The fact that he came to them and that was, and perhaps he was, who knows? We don't know how the communication and how this relationship was going down between them. Because it could easily be that Mahershala Ali was calling the shots and there was back and forth, right?
Well, listen, yeah, well, I think we can actually fill in a fair amount of these blanks because first off, okay. Mahershala Ali had worked with Netflix on Luke Cage, so not directly with Marvel Studios, but he had been part of a Marvel production. But think of the timing of when he makes this call and when this is announced, right? So this is after he wins two Oscars in 3 years. The years that he won coincide with the run-up to Endgame, right? He's announced in 2019. He's announced at the height of superhero mania. A two-time Oscar winner at the height of superhero mania goes to Kevin and says, "This is the character I was born to play." That's what he's thinking.
Yeah.
He's like, my stock is as high as it's ever going to be. I have the influence to make this call. And the superhero genre is a guaranteed success.
Yeah.
What other version of that story makes sense? So from Marvel's perspective, because we know Kevin got kind of star goggles.
Yeah.
He said yes.
Yeah.
And then Mahershala Ali, you know, he didn't go full Dwayne Johnson, but he definitely threw his weight around, right? When the Nick Pixelotto, he brought his True Detective guy in to try to save the project. I think that was him trying to...
Yeah.
All the shots, right? And
perhaps because of the MCU.
And said no. See, to me, like when Marvel came over the top and said no, and they threw out that version of the movie, whatever it was, that said to me, like, I don't know if this is going to make it. Because that's a tough one to come back from. And then they claim that the Michael Green version, the guy who did Blue Eye Samurai, the Michael Green version, people were generally happy with, and then all of a sudden that one fell apart. I will never understand. Now, here's the part I will never understand in this. And this is where I think Marvel wears a lot of responsibility. We know somewhere in this timeline, Chad Stahelski, the director of John Wick, pitches Kevin Feige on directing Mahershala Ali in Blade. Why did Marvel pass? So you have one of the hottest action directors in Hollywood saying he loves Blade, has an R-rated take on Blade, so you could have a two-time Oscar winner and John Wick's director. And Marvel said no? What exactly were you trying to push into this movie that you said that was not good enough? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Because, what am I missing? Like, I'm not saying Chad Stahelski, Steven Spielberg, but, like, look at the John Wick movies. His action hand is as good as there is in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So I could put that with vampires?
Yeah, I can believe vampires falling down the stairs for 20 minutes. Not regular human beings. I'm sorry.
There you go.
I just can't watch it.
There you go. So I'm just saying that's the moment where I'm like, to me, Marvel clearly wanted this movie to be all about something else than what it should have been about all along. And because they refused to make that movie, and then we got the verification from disgraced Bo DeMeo saying that his version of Blade that he wrote along this same timeline was basically the raid with vampires. So you had guys pitching you consummate action.
No-brainer ideas.
And Marvel's like, nah.
Nah.
That's not what this movie's about. Come on, man. We can kind of sense what's going on here, and it's not good. And it just was not meant to be.
But it is like, how do you say... But yeah to Iron Man 3? Yeah to the Marvels? Yeah to Captain Marvel? Yeah to Thor Love and Thunder? But you can't say yeah to whatever they're trying to do over there, Blade. It could be whatever is not.
I mean, that kind of fits, though, right? Like, some of the themes they focused on in Love and Thunder and some of the themes they focused on in the Marvels and some of the themes that they seem to want to focus on in Blade versus the ones that are being pitched, it does kind of line up.
It just smells funny, that's all.
Well, you know who's going to be the winner of that is Henry Cavill, because he gets Chad Stahelski directing him in Highlander. And I think that's going to be a badass movie when it comes out.
I never got into the Highlander films, but I know there's a fan base for it. So that's, and then Harry Cowell has his fan base. So that's just cha-ching anyway. So Brian, this thought of the Midnight Suns, your thought on that? It had the opportunity. I've always thought of that. Listen, you have to have something outside of the Avengers because you just can't wait all these years to get that $1 billion, right? Why not build towards another team, right?
Well, but
you could do a horror sort of thing with the Midnight Suns. You could have had that going. Ryan, I believe, and I'll say this before I get your take on the Midnight Suns, X-Men should not be the first film. The X-Men should be treated like, the formation of the X-Men should be like similar to the Avengers. Go ahead.
I go back and forth. There is a world where starting with the team of Midnight Suns can work.
Okay.
Some of the, I think back to some of my favorite movies of all time. I always talk about the Magnificent Seven. I mean, that's kind of the idea. You're putting the team together in the first movie. You don't do a movie about Chris and about Vin, like Lee, like, they go down and they fight the bandits right at the end, right? So this idea that you have to do an individual character film or show for every single character before you get the team up, it's not a must. But given the state of the franchise, I am far more concerned than I am excited when I see that headline. And what I'm getting in my head is a lot of Justice League vibes of Warner Brothers was rushing to match the Avengers. Yeah. They just trampled good storytelling along the way and got a box office turd as a result. Marvel can't get Blade off the ground. Marvel's back and forth on what they want to do with Ghost Rider. Moon Knight came and went. Like, so now they're like, well, we'll just... fast, we got this Thunderbolts thing going. We'll just go right to these team movies. And I'm kind of like, if you do 3, 4, 5 of these and a couple of them aren't good, I mean, who's going to show up?
You're getting MCUs turning into Sony now, almost.
You say it for what it is. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not saying that the Midnight Suns, we had to wait 10 years. We could have listened. I believe, isn't Doctor Strange a member of the Midnight Suns?
Midnight Suns has a large roster over time, right? So there's a lot of flexibility in terms of who you can include. There's some core members, and then there's like individual comic writers have changed the roster. So, yes.
Two or three movies would have done it. Two or three movies to the third or fourth movie could have led you to that team up. Because you have Ghost Rider, a big prominent character in the MCU that hasn't been done right, and you have now in the possession of the MCU, so we want to see what you can do with this character, and the hopes is you don't Hulk it, right? Mess it up, destroy it, because that's what you've done with the Hulk anyway. You have, and then you have Blade, right? You have two characters there that you can do that can lead you to that team up movie.
I think it's the point about teams. I think if we're going to live in the world where we've got Avengers movies and, you know, we got Fantastic Four, they're a team, they're family, but they're a team. And you're going to have Thunderbolts as a team. And now you're going to have Midnight Suns as a team, and now you're going to do X-Men as a team. So that's 5 teams that I just outlined. And then you're going to do Young Avengers. That's 6 teams. I mean, we ain't building the NFL here.
A-Force?
So my point is, when you do that, it puts a premium in my mind that they have to be tonally different. They have to look different. They have to feel different. There has to be something unique. If all you're going to do is be like, this movie basically is the Avengers, except it's got Blade and Ghost Rider, that will fail spectacularly. So to your, this goes to your point about, like, if you make it true horror, if you make it true art, if you're going to create something very gothic that is so different and so dark that, like, you instantly know it's just radically different than what you see with the Avengers, that could work. But my problem with that is, do you want to do that with the team right out of the gate? Don't you want to test drive that idea with one, maybe two, maybe do a two, maybe do a duo as opposed to just one, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's, I think my concern when you do stuff like this and it doesn't work is it's a setback to the library. It's like if you had Midnight Suns movie with 6-7 characters and the movie bombs, it's not like you can then do spinoffs of those. Remember Black Adam, all those spinoffs we were going to get? Where's that Hawkman spinoff? When's that happening? That happening? Let's call Aldous Hodge's agent. That happening? Okay. When you do bad team-ups and you bomb out of the gate with the team, nothing happens after that. So if Marvel's going to have 5 or 6 teams and 4 or 5 of these team-ups aren't going to work, that's a lot of characters you got to put on the shelf for a while.
Yeah. You going to say something about the X-Men?
To our prior discussion, we're going to keep stumping for it. We're going to keep riding for it until Marvel does it. But I think we're not going to carry the torch for this. The Penguin's going to carry the torch for us. Green Lantern's going to carry the torch for us. If those shows mint audience, mint Emmys, and mint money,
that is the route that they shall take.
On Marvel to put X-Men as leads of shows, not sideshow characters, but the things we've talked about. Why do you have to introduce all of them on the big screen? It's not an insult. Okay, fine. You don't want to do Wolverine Anthology, even though it's a great TV idea. Fine. You don't have to do that. You can do others. You can introduce other core X-Men on Disney Plus. Do it right. Take it serious. Get a big actor in there. Get a big showrunner in there. Make us be excited when they transition to the big screen. Yeah. I think there's going to be pressure on Marvel to do that because of what DC's doing.
How the tables have turned. Armor Wars.
Ugh.
The Armor Wars writer speaks out. Brian, what did he say?
Obviously, Armor Wars started out as a TV show, was changed to a movie. We've never actually had any commentary from people. Yeah. We never had any commentary, though, on along the way what was actually going on, other than even Don Cheadle kind of saying, like, he didn't know. We finally got one of the writers on the show to speak, Yasir Lester, who apparently wrote scripts for the TV series. He said, and I think this is pretty honest, he said, quote, "I think the story I told is a very fun series, not film." He said, "But I think that Marvel is constantly in a state of what is most interesting. And honestly, I believe some of their films should have been series and some of their series should have been films. And I think they're taking that more into account and trying to give that more thought now." End quote. Amen to that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this project necessarily should have been either, but
yeah,
I think
he's
spot on that. I think Marvel has sometimes guessed and been wrong about the medium for where they put certain products.
And wrong about where to go, what to do next, where to go ahead with their stories.
My thing has been, I think the Thunderbolts would have been better as a prestige show. And I think we'll see if I'm right about that. But that's one that comes to mind going the other way. You could argue there's parts of something like Loki that might have been more cinematic than it could ever be on television. You could argue that. We've just talked about the X-Men. But I do think Marvel has not always been finger on the pulse about where a character should be displayed.
I think you got too many people over there at Marvel who are feeling themselves too much and thinking that they know what's best. And look at where it's gotten you. What else could it be?
I think it's also, if you look at the way the world was when Endgame went to the theaters, Disney Plus wasn't even a thing yet, right?
No.
And then we went through this phase because of COVID where everyone thought streaming was going to take over the world. And so there was unlimited content, unlimited investment, willing to lose unlimited money just to get that next subscriber. Yeah. So Disney, like everyone else, was thinking, okay, everything's going to be Disney Plus, basically. And then I feel like that caused, in some ways, the movies to suffer. I don't think that was unrelated. And now I think they're in this world of they're not totally sure of what should go where. And I think in fairness to them, DC has one major advantage they don't have, which is HBO, the network. That's a channel that has an identity that's been built over decades of what they show on TV, not on streaming. There is no Disney net. I mean, there's Disney Channel for kids, but there's no Disney network that has shown primetime television forever. So I don't think they've quite figured that out yet.
Certainly they've taken the risks in order to believe they are able to do so, Brian, and it just hasn't worked out, obviously. But when you get, when you make the money that the MCU was making, you have people who have been there from Jump Street given the keys to do something based on the success that they've gotten. And that's the way the approach towards the 6-episode series came along. That's where that whole thing started. And it just hasn't worked out for them. But they seem to have... I know you say Agatha. I know Agatha isn't, you know, nowhere near the same level as Penguin, but it's still, you have people out there that are really enjoying this show. Yeah. Let's see if they can turn it around.
The lack of, yeah, and I think they're enjoying the. It is more derivative. It's not as connected. It's probably being unburdened a little bit by, you know, not having as much action or not having as much sort of MCU-ishness to live up to, if you will. That's probably helped the show. It's not really for me. Like, I don't think it's my favorite thing.
Yeah,
it's
not bad.
I think it's well made. I think it's pretty well conceived, but like, it's just not my favorite subject matter. But you're seeing Marvel move toward the DC model in the sense of right now they have a tradition. They're doing traditional showrunners, traditional writers' room. Right, they weren't doing that for the first rounds of shows. They were kind of thinking they could reinvent the TV model by kind of doing it movie-like, but just on TV. And that hasn't worked. But where DC has the jump on them clearly is, I think the resume and the prestige of who's doing their shows is just better right now. Now, that will change. Someday, somebody huge will do a Marvel TV show and some huge lead will do it. And that probably will change the tide. But for right now, it's like the Lindelofs and the Mundys and the director of Slow Horses and the Matt Reeves of the world. They're working over at, in the DC and the HBO lot, you know, not saying the talent is bad on the Marvel side. It's just there's less of a proven commodity in some of these showrunners so far, but we'll see, you know, we'll see what comes.
Speaking of troublesome projects,
we got to start odds on Blade versus this. Go ahead.
I think the same odds. No,
there's a
no
lot of
chance.
Commonality to these two projects. Go ahead.
Daisy Ridley, Star Wars loses another writer. And Mango Star Wars idea of the genesis of the Jedi, the Force, that idea has been creeping up into a possible green light, Brian. Your thoughts on this? I don't know why we're still talking about it, really. But your thoughts.
So we had actually hinted at this in an earlier show. There were rumors about this, now confirmed. So Stephen Knight, best known as the creator of Peaky Blinders, is no longer writing the Daisy Ridley Star Wars movie, New Jedi Order. As I said, I figured that would make sense because Stephen Knight is now directing and writing the Peaky Blinders movie, which I think is going to be kind of a hit because its lead is, of course, Cillian Murphy. That would be your reigning best actor.
Yeah.
Nice timing. You get to wrap up your TV show with a movie that happens to star the winner of best actor in the past year. Yeah, I would leave Daisy Ridley Star Wars for that too. You know, Ridley herself was asked about it and kind of was just like, whatever. Her reaction was funny. She was kind of just like, I'm not worried about it. Like, I don't know what's going on.
You mean, you know, not be worried about it.
You know, he's like, we don't have a, she goes, oh, and they asked, because remember there was a talk that was going to come out in 2026. They had a date. No, we don't have a date. I think the creative process is one that is really a journey. I'm genuinely excited, but I really do mean I'm excited about what's coming. And we have the luxury of making sure that this is right.
Yes.
She knows. She knows.
She knows. And
this has the, this has the, I said the parallels are so hilarious to the Blade movie, because there's all, there's still those rumors about Kathleen Kennedy greenlighting, announcing this movie and getting Daisy Ridley to go on stage at that event where she was supposed to resign and retire. And instead,
I'm not leaving.
Sent Daisy Ridley out as a pawn for her, you know, latest
for her continued conquest.
Exactly.
I wish I could have been in the room when them dudes is all talking about Kennedy resigning and thinking it's gonna happen. Them dudes toasting and everything, and then she says what she says, and they're like, "What?"
Oh, she says these are the droids you're looking for. She's telling you, man, she's the most powerful force wielder of all in that room. Are you kidding me?
Word up. She knows where everything is at. She has the keys.
Find your lack of faith disturbing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, just. Something, and there's, I read a report about that, that like now it's like there's all these lingering rumors that she is, she or isn't she going, and it's like, well, now they're like, well, you know, now she's safe through at least the first half of 2025. It's like she keeps hanging on. Now they are going to get a movie. They are going to get a movie, because Mando and Grogu, because Jon Favreau, yes, and Dave Filoni still do their thing. They wrapped it. It's done. So that movie is going to happen.
Oh, wow.
We knew that. We said that was going to happen. It will happen. It was filmed. It's finished. You will get that one.
Interesting.
But to your point, I think the far more interesting one is, can we get the Mangold one, which does seem like it's got a little momentum. Can we get the James Mangold Origin of the Force movie?
That's what I'm interested in, seeing how this manifests into someone, a being wielding that force and what it looks like. Because we've seen some force wielding amazing, it depends on the era that you're in, is how more fantastic it looks.
The only thing the Acolyte gave us that I thought was true to the essence of Star Wars was the kung fu action.
Oh yeah. But to see that, to see it from its genesis, and that,
I like it too, because as we talk about pitches, right? We talk about pitches for ideas. I like Mangold's pitch for this. It isn't just the Force. He said he's looking at Hollywood history. He basically has pitched this as, it's the biblical epic of Star Wars. It's the Ten Commandments, the Ben Hur of Star Wars. I'm in. That's it. What, I'm just saying, like that. It's like we said, if you can give a one sentence idea that encapsulates something interesting in this, in IP, those usually work.
So if that's
his inspiration, is that idea of like a Moses character, or like a, so it's like an actual, that kind of character wielding the Force, it's at least interesting. Like, come on, tell me you're not at least intrigued to see what that looks like.
Oh, most definitely. You put that choice and Daisy Ridley, I'm like, yo, what are you, what are we trying to do here? You know, what kind of choice are you giving me? Like, really? Like, well, why would I choose this other thing that you're giving me? You know? Yeah. Let us know in the conversation below what you guys think of this Daisy Ridley stuff. Why are we still talking about it? And give us the genesis.
Yeah.
Give us that. I want to see that, because it could finally maybe help us forget about what we've seen as of late, because this Daisy Ridley movie, again, is based on a lie. She is not a Skywalker. Why do you want to continue that? To do what? To see what? I don't know. Let's start off with a segment, Brian, because you said we should do some segments. We got to do a segment for this.
What the hell are we doing here, Harry?
Venom, Brian, I saw it. I knew. What are we doing here? He even said it in the movie when he was on that road trip to Las Vegas. I can't believe this is what are we doing? What can't believe I'm here. Venom, the Venom movie. I was surprised. I was shocked that I was listening to John Campia and I was agreeing with pretty much everything he had to say about what he thought about that movie. Because there were some aspects, Brian, I was really intrigued. That was that third act. The action was really well done. But everything else was, yo, what the hell are we doing here? Brian, when he goes to a theater, for the most part, it's usually not that crowded. Even though it will probably be crowded in New York, or for the most part, I would say over 67, it felt like a Monday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I've seen a couple of breakdowns of the films, and I've heard some of the same gripes of this film with regards to Null. What the hell are we doing here? This is perfect. Ryan, what are your thoughts? What did you think of this as you were watching it?
Yeah, so I went to see it in a large format theater, not IMAX, a 70 millimeter large format theater. So it's, you know, bigger than usual. I was one of seven people in my showing.
Okay.
So an interesting crowd too. There were like two teenagers and there was like an elderly couple, which I would have loved to have gotten their take on this. And then, you know, kind of a couple of individuals like myself kind of spread out throughout the theater. What are we doing here? I mean, you know, it's Tom Hardy's show, right? You can see it. He co-wrote the movie with Kelly Marcel, who wrote the last movie. And Kelly Marcel's one of his people. And Kelly Marcel directed this movie. So this is kind of a...
Sounds rock movie-ish.
It's a little bit of Tom Hardy loves this character. And I think they kind of just let him do what he wanted, pretty much. But I do think they let him do what he wanted in terms of what they shot. I do think the studio edited it pretty heavily because the movie feels pretty chopped to me. Yeah. When you watch it, it's sort of like, this can't be like, there must be like another 45 minutes somewhere that you kind of just had, maybe. Studio was like, nah, this is gonna be under 2 hours no matter what.
Yeah.
I'll say this. It's not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination. But I would submit none of the three movies were good movies.
No. Although I like the first one.
The first one's the best.
Because I felt like I was watching a Venom movie. And I was fine with that.
True. There was an element of fun to this, like silly fun to this, that because it, like, Madame Web was so bad, and you could tell everyone involved with it knew it was so bad that it was kind of like they quit on it day one, and you kind of feel that on screen. Like, Morbius, Jared Leto didn't get the memo this was going to be bad. And like takes it so seriously, and then it's so bad. So then it's like, that's a terrible experience. Right. And it's like, Joker is the ultimate example of people taking a movie ultra seriously and it being terrible, like from minute one. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, oh my God, how long do I have to be here? Mm-hmm. So there is this whiff in this movie of, I knew it wasn't going to be good going in. I think they knew it's not supposed to be that good, but because it's like a send-off, they kind of were like, we're just going to do the things we want to do and have a little fun with it. And I did think there was a little bit of silly fun to this that I didn't totally despise relative to the typical Sony output. Again, it's not saying it was good. I'm not going to give it a good rating.
Yeah.
But like, it went by pretty quick. I didn't feel like I was in the theater that long. So
I would say that as well. I didn't feel like I was in the theater very long, although the some of the scenes felt very long, so like the him meeting the family and him walking and trying to get to Vegas.
Because I mean the whole trilogy is held together by Eddie and Menno. That's the only, like, either you like that or you don't. But that dynamic is the only thing that has ever mattered to this trilogy. And in this movie, that is the best part of the movie. There are moments where the symbiote and him have this dynamic where it's sort of like, oh yeah, that's where this can sort of work. And when it tries to get away from that and be serious and tries to introduce other name actors for reasons unknown. I mean, Chiwetel Ejiofor, really? Is that where your career's at? That you're taking that part? I mean, this guy's been nominated for an Academy Award. Like, really? Like, Juno Temple is nominated for an Emmy and Ted Lasso. Like, really? Like, that's where we're at with these characters, with these actors? Like, I don't... They added nothing. Like, why are they in this movie?
Name
on the poster. They also ruined the symbiote, right? Let's be fair. Like, this is the... Like, party's on his way out. They're doing whatever the hell they want. And... Because remember, like, the whole point of, like, Eddie and the symbiote is, like, there's a bond that has to be there.
Yeah.
That makes that duality interesting. And in the final act of this movie, it's like, you and I can be symbiotes. Like, just give us a little goo and we'll just turn into, you know, I don't know what, exactly. I don't know what I'd get. Would I get cool hair? I don't know what I'd get if I was. But, like, that's what we got. All sorts of colors, all sorts of shapes, all sorts of sizes, right? Which kind of makes it silly. But that's where I sort of was like, you know what? It's not the worst set piece I've ever seen. They're just, they know that they're not taking this seriously, and they're just kind of goofing around a little bit.
Out of five, what would you give it?
1.5.
Yeah, I was thinking the same. I was thinking, because I was entertained by the action sequences, because I was really like, yo, how the hell are they going to get out of this?
So they kept me engaged.
I would give it a 2.
Okay. I mean, to me, Null is just like Sony being Sony. That's all that is to me, right? What is the library of things that Sony has tried to tease in this movie, these movies that we know will never happen? Vulture and Morbius. We've had the Madam Web, whatever that was, by the end of the...
What the hell are we doing here? Yes.
Right? So, like, we've had these... In these different, and we've had Venom crossing over into the Spider-Verse, but then not crossing over. Like, Sony has given you all these franchise directions they intend to go in that will never happen. And this movie had like 3 of those, and the entire character of Null is that. I mean, he didn't even get to be the Galactus Cloud. That's how useless he was.
But some of the breakdowns that I hear and the possibilities of showing up in like Secret Wars or something, setting them up for something else. They're like, who cares? This is definitely not that Thanos turn and reveal. This is
Not
by a long shot.
I'm sure Sony thought it was when they put that scene together where he looks up, which is hilarious because it's like, we just spent 2 hours with them telling us if we destroy the Codex, copyright alert, Man of Steel, leave it look the same, by the way, like shimmering light thing. I was like,
Codex. So
we got told for 2 hours, if we destroy the Codex, we can keep Null in prison forever. And yet Null tells us immediately in midway through the credits, I'm awake. I'm back. I'm going to look up. Yeah. So that's how you know the movie just didn't mean anything. But.
Yeah. But let us know in the comment section below what you guys thought of the movie. If you saw it, if you didn't. Good for you. There's really no reason, unless you like the first two films. If you didn't like the first two films, then don't waste your time. If you like the first one
a little more than two, I gotta be honest.
Yes, exactly. I did too.
I'd say 1, 3, 2 is how I would tell you.
Yes,
these are. Yeah.
Netflix animation, Brian, Tomb Raider and Terminator Zero. Tomb Raider, Brian. I started watching the first episode, and then there's one thing where she was trying to get across because the latter wasn't really accessible because it was, you know, old and whatever.
Yep.
And then they give her, they show a shot of her looking across and thinking like, and then you see her rope at the other end. I don't know how they got over there secure. I don't know how I got over there. And I was like, I can't watch this. But Terminator Zero. You go ahead about Tomb Raider. What's your thoughts on that?
So the reason why I thought the reason why I thought this could be a show is because there's parts of IP that we don't always kind of focus on. But I think that Netflix, well, we've talked about this golden age of animation that's sort of taking hold in sort of superhero specific, but it's kind of going beyond that. And I think Netflix has been a pretty good agent of this. And because it's Netflix, they don't necessarily promote these individually, maybe the way they should, right? So like Blue Eye Samurai becomes this massive hit, but it's not because Netflix necessarily positioned it as this one-of-one show. It just became that. Yeah. You know, I'm not as well-versed in some of the properties. You watched, you know, the Castlevanias, the Blood of Zeus, right? These are things that Netflix has done for a while that have followings, but don't necessarily get huge attention. But these were interesting to me because these were two mainstream IPs that most people are familiar with that Netflix took to animate. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested to just see like what they would do with them. And I have different opinions on both, but I think both are worth a watch would be my first take, is that I think Tomb Raider is flawed. But I think Hayley Atwell does a really good job as the voice of Lara. And I think the animation is pretty good. And I think there's enough in the show that you're kind of like, all right, they already announced the season two. And I was like, I'd come back and watch another season. My main complaints would be, I don't think there's enough puzzling in the show. Like if you think about the video game, a lot of the video game really is these like true riddle solving, problem solving to get from place to place and to get through these tombs and these elaborate structures.
Yes.
And I think Lara in this show is a little too straightforward at points. She just kind of knows everything and it kind of just like moves. So my advice to them in season two would be make it harder for her. Like make these more challenging puzzles that we spend more time in these places to kind of get the object. But I think
I think that was one of the most intriguing parts of like National Treasure and stuff like that.
No doubt. 100%. So that's why I would say like the show to me is weaker than it should be. But I think the characters are somewhat interesting. She's got Richard Armitage, who's a pretty good actor, as sort of the bad guy. He's got a great voice. So I think it's a worthwhile watch. I'd probably give it like, you know, 3 stars out of 5. Like it's flawed, but like I think it's an easy thing to get through the 8 episodes. And I think you'll, you know, be like, all right, that's pretty easy. Terminator, I thought was more interesting because that IP, I've wondered, is it dead? Like dead?
No.
And this show made me rethink that. And I was kind of like, and it's funny because we'll talk about Cameron in a second. I think he's finally ready to do something again in live action with Terminator. And this show, I wonder if it might even give him ideas about what to do with it. But it took me a couple episodes to get into it. I got to be honest, the first couple episodes, I wasn't sure. I was like, But right around episode 4, where like, kind of like this, where Skynet launches and Kokoro comes online, from that point onward,
you
gotta see this show. That's it.
I would say, Ryan, that this show gives me the same suspense and feeling as watching the original Terminator. And the subject matter as well that they talk about human race and, you know, all that stuff is sort of a little bit of an anxiety in it because, you know, we're living in times where, you know, anything go
wrong. Well, clearly nobody's taking any lessons from the Terminator franchise. None.
I like the female character that they send back. One of the things that I sort of think and scratch my head is when she's fighting the Terminator, there are some skills that obviously she's learned in order to deal with them, but taking direct hits from them, that's a different story.
Yeah.
Whereas with other beings, he was handling very easily. So that was one of the things. But still, that the Terminator aspect of it is still, I think, still has that original Terminator feeling to it.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because Terminator 1 and Terminator 2 are two completely different genres. And it's interesting that I feel like as we've gone forward and the franchise has kind of metastasized, everything has really been built around Terminator 2, not Terminator 1.
Yeah.
Terminator 1 is a low budget, basically indie horror movie where Michael Myers happens to be a cyborg. That's basically what that movie is. Yeah. Terminator 2 is a blockbuster, maybe the blockbuster action movie ever made.
Yeah.
It could not be more different.
Yeah.
So you're right. This show feels very small, even though the stakes are global, if that makes sense. Like, the combat is very like one-to-one in small spaces. It's like, you know, in corners and alleys and elevators. And but then you know that the stakes are basically like the end of the world, right? The end of civilization. Yeah. I think that, you know, it took me a little while. I'll be honest. It took me a little while to get with the protagonist, with the female soldier. Maybe because, and maybe this is my point about the IP, maybe because this franchise has always been built around Sarah in some ways as this sort of freedom fighter, it almost feels hard to do that again and make it relevant. Because in Terminator 1, she's an innocent, right? She basically has no skills at all.
She has
some spirit, which she uses at the end, but she has no fighting skills. Where in the second one, she effectively is a Terminator herself.
Yeah.
You see that when she goes to kill Dyson.
Yeah.
And then they kind of try to keep redoing that, right? The Mackenzie Davis character in Dark Fate is basically like a souped up Sarah-ish character who then needs Sarah herself. And so on. So it took me a while to get there. I was far more interested in the Malcolm Lee character, which I thought was a very well-conceived character. They took the Dyson idea and they actually made it, spoiler alert, like a time-traveling character, which I thought was cool. Like this idea of what if we kind of had this almost multiversal approach to Skynet itself? Are there some moments of action that defy realism? Yes, but you know why I forgive it? Because it's so well staged. I think it's drawn so well. And they use the violence so well. And Timothy Oliphant, using him as the voice of the Terminator, even though he doesn't have that many lines, I think is a good choice. So it works. I think it works in that sense of the action looks good and it is compelling.
Yes.
And there are enough actual fatalities and injuries to where you're kind of like, you don't totally know what's going to happen in each exchange. So I think the show really builds incredible momentum into the finale to where I'm like, they haven't said, I don't think, if there is going to be a season two of this, but I am really hoping for one. And like I said, James Cameron out of nowhere said he has an idea and is working on the actual Terminator sequel to his story.
So it would be Terminator 3.
Yeah, but he kind of said it would be like Terminator 1 in the sense of He said something about Dark Fate because he produced Dark Fate. It was the first one he had any involvement in, which is not a terrible movie. But he said the reason it failed is there's no attempt in Dark Fate to build a new audience. He's like, we're relying on Arnold. We're relying on all this. We're relying on Linda Hamilton. We're relying on all the same tropes.
Yeah.
And in order to expand the audience, we need actual new ideas that are true to Terminator idea. To do that. And I think this show kind of beat him to that. This show achieved that. And that's why I wonder if he will certainly be aware of it. And I'm sure he'll look at this and be like, yeah, there's stuff in here I can probably use.
Yeah.
But if James Cameron is ever going to do a true next Terminator movie, that will be a hit because it's him.
Of course. Of course. And he's going to get whatever money he needs to get what he needs to get done.
And similarly to, we talk about in the Star Wars, getting away from the Skywalkers, I think he finally realizes he has to get away from Arnold. Like, Arnold can't be in. It doesn't work if he's in it in any way.
Yeah. Interesting. Unless he does a cameo. if it'll be a cool, like, the first model was built off of his resemblance or like
whatever his model was.
Yeah. Yes. He was the foundation or the out of respect. Whatever. That would be a cool story. But why did they make this dude look like him? But anyway.
So I would just say to people, you know, these shows are not on the level of Blue Eye Samurai. And if you haven't seen any of them, watch Blue Eye Samurai first. Because yes. That's a 5-star show. That's the one and only reason. But if you're hunting around and you're looking for something animated that is involves worlds you know and you're not going to waste your time, give these shows a shot. Like
Terminator Zero was definitely one of those.
There's some stuff there.
Definitely. But yeah, let us know in the comment section below what you guys think of everything that we've actually talked about today. It's been a lot. We're at the 1:30 mark. Blade, Midnight Suns, Armor Wars. None of them seeming to go anywhere except for probably Midnight Suns because there's more to gain. I don't know how, Brian. How there's more to gain with Midnight Suns, being that you haven't really set up anything and you think. Because, granted, you got to find out what Thunderbolts is going to do. And what Captain America's going to do. If none of these movies, Brian, which we don't think is going to probably do well.
I think 2025, the ones that I'm focused on Superman and Fantastic Four. I hate to say I've given up on the other two, but I kind of have. Like, I just don't think they're going to be hit. It's Fantastic Four and it's Superman. If those two can be big hits for the genre will move forward.
I just hope that they don't make a humdinger Galactus, man. That's what I'm scared of. That's what I'm afraid of. Him peeking in the building, like, where are you? You know what I'm saying?
Before we sign up, I have to do this. There's some box office stuff I got to leave you with before we go into. So we got the fall coming up. We just had Venom. So Venom did about 50 million US opening weekend. That obviously was a disappointment. First two movies were 80 and 90. We got the box office tracking for
Wicked,
which is going to be supposedly 100 to 125 million opening weekend. No surprise really there. Gladiator 2, a 3-hour Gladiator 2 rated R. The tracking for the opening weekend right now is 60 to 80. You're pretty close. That's huge.
Okay.
For a 3-hour R-rated movie, that's an enormous number.
Yeah.
So that's actually a really good sign for that film. But then there's Red One. And I just got to say, I couldn't leave it. You know, we got two veterans of the comic book genre here in a $250 million budgeted movie. Actually, three. Let's not forget J.K. Simmons also has been in the genre as well. So your headliners, Dwayne Johnson, Chris Evans, J.K. Simmons in a $250 million Christmas family action movie, Red One, and the opening weekend range is 20 to 35 million, Pablo. That is a disaster for The Rock.
I don't know why people or executives are getting into these partnerships with, granted, yes, he's using his fan base as leverage. Look at me. I have 500 million subscribers or fans. That's money, right? Yes, of course. Right?
Sounds like a lot of bootlegs.
Sounds like a lot of bots that aren't buying tickets and showing up to the theaters. Because this is not good. How do you? I'm telling you, I want to hear what he has to say about this. This next failure. What is it going to be about this time? That's what I want to hear. If I'm gonna just throw my hands up in the air if he says, oh, we made profit on this movie, this is the number, I'm gonna throw my hands up in the air and be like, whatever, y'all, whatever. But it doesn't make sense.
Don't forget when they announced this movie, what they said it was gonna be. Quote, Red One is a 4-quadrant holiday family film that is planned to be a large franchise with merchandising across the Amazon universe. This is supposed to launch an entire universe, and it's going to lose an enormous amount of money.
I hope
after
that
Black Adam was supposed to change the hierarchy and launch an entire universe in DC centered on Dwayne Johnson, and that never happened.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson is the universe destroyer.
Maybe
that's what he is. Word up, yo. Word up, yo. I mean, he's supposed to be Apocalypse in, apparently, there's some rumor, right? Isn't there some rumor that he's supposed to be?
There's been a rumor of that.
Yeah. I pray to God, no, man. Because come on.
What the hell are we doing here, Harry?
$250 million? And you're tracking 25, 30 million, and you're not going to probably make any profit. And all these thoughts and hopes that you have for to make what Tracy would call lunchbox money. Right? Franchise all these little things you want to sell and stuff, and it's nothing. You're not getting your return despite what that 500 million. Subscriber base or fans that he has.
Well, we did get the teaser that he's working with J.J. Abrams on a movie now.
Oh, yeah, right? I know. I mean, he gave you the same shot only with three other people. He had the same shot with Henry Cavill the other time, right? Didn't he have that with a nice summer and the sun was in the background, all that?
Yep.
And now he's doing it with these guys to do what, from what I heard, I think Jeff Snyder was on a podcast talking about what this film is about, and it's similar to Iron Eagle. Remember Iron Eagle?
I remember Iron Eagle. Shouts to and rest in peace, Louis Gossett Jr.
Yeah, Louis Gossett Jr. Yeah, one of my favorite movies growing up. It's something similar to that, Brian, but with whatever it is I'm telling you. The stuff that The Rock does is whack. I'm sorry, yo. You can't tell me that you can't. There's nothing that you can say that he's done late that's dope. And this is just another example of his star power really not meaning anything because it's not attached to what? Quality.
Yeah, and look, I mean.
What kind of quality? Storytelling. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, like, I know this was going into a whole other subject, but we had to talk about it, is, you know, things were looking pretty bleak for Henry Cavill. But look what's happened since he got out from under the thumb. Like, at first, we were kind of being like, Warhammer, that's all you got? But then, you know.
Voltron.
I think Highlander is going to work.
Highlander,
I think Voltron, with Amazon's backing, has real potential. He started getting some roles like in the Guy Ritchie verse, like Minister of Gentlemanly Warfare. He started going back to like doing some smaller parts in kind of, you know, movies that let him act a little bit more. And all of a sudden you're like, Henry Cavill as star is headed back in the right direction.
But all of that happened
immediately after he shed himself from the camp.
Book.
Exactly. Fired the agent, got away from that after the Superman embarrassment.
That's what that was, an embarrassment. That was a plot to trick you into thinking something was happening when in fact it wasn't.
Yeah, no, that was The Rock. You got to find that clip of Carl Weathers from Predator.
You're an asset, an expendable asset. And I used you to get the job done. Got it?
That's what The Rock did to Henry Cavill.
Yeah, man. I was watching Predator the other day. Fantastic movie, yo. Fantastic. Perfect movie. It's a perfect movie.
It's a perfect movie. No, that's correct. So I will say that, like, Arnold's Hall of Fame movie will always probably be Terminator 2. That's the biggest movie. But my favorite movie he ever did is Predator.
Yeah, it was Predator, yeah. Anyway. Let's sign off. Let us know in the comment section below what you guys think of everything that we've talked about. And we'll see you next time on the Nerd Gen Report.
The show goes-